The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And. My guest today is Charles Duhigg. Charles is a reporter for the New York Times. His reporting on Apple won him a Pulitzer Prize in 2013. His latest book is Smarter, Faster, Better, which follows on the heels of his other best-selling book, The Power of Habit. He has an MBA from Harvard Business School and has been seen and heard on such programs as This American Life, The Colbert Report, and Frontline. Charles Duhigg, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thanks for having me on.
So one of the things I love about both of your books, The Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better, is how many big ideas you uncover in rather small regions of study. And one of my favorite examples is in your chapter on teams in your latest book. And while you talk about Saturday Night Live, which we know a little bit about, I thought that the story about the two different teams of nurses that a Harvard PhD student studied was utterly fascinating. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting study where Amy Edmondson, who is now at Harvard Business School and was then, as you mentioned, a Harvard PhD student, she originally started working on a project where she wanted to look at accident rates within hospitals. And so she was looking at different units within hospitals. And what she found is that some units would have relatively high accident rates, where others would have lower accident rates. And by accidents, I mean, you know, giving the wrong medication or somehow messing up like a measurement that you're taking. So it's something that might put patient health at risk, but it's not a calamity, right? But these are things that the nurses are doing which are somehow incorrect. They're making a mistake. And as she's looking at these different rates, what she thinks is that, well, she finds some units that have a lot of mistakes and others that don't have mistakes. And she figures that the units that are having mistakes, they must be teams that don't work together very well, right? It must be that everyone feels really uptight or that they don't get along. And that's why all these mistakes are happening. And the units that are reporting very low levels of mistakes, they must be fantastic teams. Everyone must get along really well. Mm-hmm. So she starts collecting all this data from the nurses. She asks them questions like, do you feel like you have any friends on the team? Do you feel like this is a well-managed team? Is the leader someone you can like? And what she finds is exactly the opposite of what she expects to find. The units that have a high mistake rate, they are great teams. Everyone on those teams says, I love being on this team. The units with low mistake rates, where it seems like nothing is wrong is happening, they all say, this is a terrible team. I can't get along. And so she thinks to herself, this doesn't make any sense. Why on earth would a good team cause more accidents? So she starts looking closer and closer at the data. And what she realizes pretty quickly is it's not that teams that are dysfunctional have lower accident rates or mistake rates. It's that teams that are dysfunctional, nobody admits that they're making a mistake. That people are so uptight on bad teams that they feel like they can't admit when they did something wrong. Yeah. They have to hide it, or they have to somehow cover it up. That good teams allow us to be honest about what we're doing that's incorrect. And that, in fact, the teams where everyone feels close to each other, the teams that where everyone gets along, those are the teams where not only can they admit that they make mistakes, but they can also get better. Right. Because admitting that you make a mistake is the first step towards improving. And out of this came this kind of big insight, which is that some teams have this thing called psychological safety. Mm-hmm. And we know from study after study, including Saturday Night Live, as well as research that's been done at Google's attempt to build the perfect team, that the best teams all tend to have one characteristic in common, which is psychological safety, the ability to make a mistake and admit it to your teammates and feel like your teammates won't hold it against you. The capacity to bring your whole self to work and to bring up some crazy idea and not feel like everyone's going to think that you're an idiot for bringing that up and that in the future they're going to exclude you from something. That if you feel psychologically safe within a group, then you have the ability to make that group come together and improve. So so that the team becomes stronger than all of the individuals who are making it up.
Right. So I'm on an airplane and I read this and I literally made a noise out loud. And my seatmate was like, "What are you reading?" And I'm like, "Well, this really good book." And I go, "And it completely relates to our work." And he's like, "What do you do?" And so then I have to explain all the Second City stuff. But what I honed in on is an adage. So we've all heard the term, your team is only as good as its weakest member. And at Second City, we actually spin that adage and we call our teams ensembles. And we say your ensemble is only as good as its ability to compensate for its weakest member. So the onus is put back on the group because every individual at some point is going to be the weakest member. But that's not an orientation that is common in business. It's the opposite. It's what you're talking about. But we believe ours because, you know, improvisation is just it's rife with failure. And to do it and to be resilient and to grow and to use mistakes, one has to be comfortable with, I think Bob Sutton calls it a manageable mess.
I think that's exactly right. And that acknowledgement that everyone is going to fail at some point, that's really, really important, right? Mm-hmm. Because without that, mistakes become something to be embarrassed by. They're basically a failure.
Right.
And what we know about people who are productive, what we know about people who are successful, is that they almost don't have the ability to see failures as failures.
Right.
Instead, what they see failures as is they see it as an experiment that yielded some data. And in this case, the data was that didn't work. You need to try something else. But there's such a shame, there's such an emotional stigma associated with failure that people who are very successful, they manage to translate that into something else, into a learning opportunity instead of something that I have to feel bad about.
Right, right. And the other aspect of this, and I quote you, you say a communal culture replaced individual needs. And that's this thing about teams and about ensembles. And one of the things that I've always found fascinating about a place like Second City is we have a complete ensemble approach, right? You have to make your partner look good. It's all about the group. And yet all we do is produce individual stars. That's what we are absolutely known for. And I think people think that's counterintuitive to build stars inside ensembles, but that's absolutely not the case. I think it feeds each other, right? You boost your ability.
I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. You can express your individuality, but you also learn from the group that's around you.
Well, and what's interesting is my guess is, and tell me if this is right, is that if I was to talk to that star about why they became a star, what they would talk about is they would talk about the team, right? That they would talk about the fact that they had some back and forth with someone, that they feel so creatively fertile when they're working with these three other people, that the star might not see themselves as a star. It's more that the external sees them. And I think Saturday Night Live is a perfect example of this, right?
Oh, yeah.
We tend to look at Saturday Night Live as a collection of individuals. We say the Eddie Murphy era was fantastic. Or right now, you know, I love Will Ferrell and maybe we mention two or three people per season.
Mm-hmm.
But from talking to people who've worked on Saturday Night Live, when they're inside that writer's room, when they're inside that theater, they don't tend to talk about individuals. Instead of what they tend to talk about, and my guess is that everyone that you work with in Second City feels the same way, is that they tend to talk about the group experience. Because the most brilliant moments, the time when Will Ferrell seems funniest or Eddie Murphy seems funniest, it's because the group has set up a joke. And as an observer, we might not be aware of who's giving the assist there. We only see the payoff. But the comedian, the performer knows that it's the group and the assist that only makes that moment possible.
Yeah, completely. I mean, one of my favorite stories along that, because it started at Second City and then they both went on to Saturday Night Live, was Chris Farley's famous Matt Foley character in Living in the Van Down by the River. Chris was not a writer. Chris was an incredible performer. And Bob Odenkirk, who was in the cast with him at Second City, was basically like, "I'm a writer. I'm going to write this for you," and handed it word for word to Chris. And he just loved how successful he was in that. And then they took it to SNL. And, you know, very few people knew that Bob was the guy who created every single piece of that. But there was no ego in that because they were part of this ensemble. They had this sort of cultural viewpoint. And then that's the great thing about SNL is they knock it up a notch. Right. So you're in Chicago. Go ahead.
Yeah. Who knew that Saul Goodman set up
you're right.
a band down by the river?
Yes, Saul Goodman did it. Oh, you're right. All right. So the other thing I want to talk to you about is focus, because I thought that this area is very, very interesting. And it's elemental to the practice of improvisation, because before you learn anything in an improv class, we make you do these games where you like pass an imaginary ball, or you silently give and take focus. And often the students don't know why we're making them do all this stuff. But you actually identify two key areas related to people's ability to be productive. And one is this cognitive tunneling, and the other is generating mental models. And so what is it about our ability to focus and be productive with those sort of two elements at play?
Well, see, it's a really interesting question. So there's this basic question, which is why are some people better at being focused than others, right? What do we know about people who seem to have control over their attention and not get distracted by unimportant details, and others who you know, are great workers, they love to get stuff done, but it's like every 10 minutes they need to check Twitter or Facebook, and like there's like some blinking light, you know, and it distracts them from what's going on. Why are some people better at multitasking but being focused on the right things, and other people kind of are ADD? And here's what we found out, is that the people who are best at focusing, they tend to tell themselves stories about what they're doing as they do it. And within psychology, this is known as building a mental model, right? That I have a picture in my head of what should be happening right now. And that, on an almost subconscious level, helps my attention decide which elements of what's happening in the world match up with the picture, and I should pay attention to them, and which don't, and so I can safely set them aside or pay more attention if it's some type of emergency. So here's what we know, for instance, about the best executives. Executives who are uniquely successful, they tend to tell themselves stories about their days that are a little bit more detailed than everyone else. So most of us, when we have a meeting at 10 o'clock, think to ourselves, I've got a meeting at 10 o'clock, I need to get these papers ready for it, and then I've got lunch at 11, and I should, you know, leave the office. Mm-hmm. The best executives, and we know this from a study of the Fortune 500, the best executives, the most successful ones, they say, I've got a meeting at 10 o'clock. And you know what? The way that meeting is going to start, it's going to start by Jim bringing up that stupid idea he brings up every single time. And then Beth is going to disagree with him because they like used to have this affair and now they're fighting with each other. And so she's going to disagree with him. And then after that happens, then I'm going to bring up my idea and I'm going to win the meeting because everyone's going to be so distracted by Jim and Beth that when my idea comes, it's going to sound brilliant, right? In other words, what they do is they tend to visualize the day ahead of them with just half an inch more specificity, half an inch more detail than everyone else. But that half an inch makes all the difference because by building a mental model, it allows them to figure out what to focus on during that meeting and what they can safely ignore. And that's called building a mental model. Now, you mentioned also cognitive tunneling, and cognitive tunneling is like what happens when we don't have a mental model. And we've all felt cognitive tunneling. You're in a cognitive tunnel when you're driving down the freeway and you're going the speed limit and you see a cop car out of the corner of your eye and you suddenly hit the brake needlessly, right? Or when you're at home and you're making dinner and you're talking to your spouse and you're setting out plates for the kids and suddenly your phone buzzes and it's a text message from your boss and you like type some response and hit send. And as soon as you hit send, you think to yourself, I really wish I'd waited a couple minutes before hitting send to really think about this. A cognitive tunnel is when there's so many inputs that our brain tends to latch on to the most obvious stimuli and react to it right away. That's what happens when we don't have a story in our head, when we don't know how to guide our attention. Our attention just looks at the shiniest blinking light and focuses on it at the exclusion of everything else. And that's why when you're doing those improv exercises, I used to be in an improv group in college, and we would do those, right? We would start by passing the ball. The reason why is because it trains you to create a story on the fly in your head that allows you to figure out, okay, when my colleague on the stage says something, I can pick that up and I can fit that into the story that I'm creating, as opposed to simply saying, I'm just going to react. I'm not going to have any control to pick and choose which parts of this scene I want to run with. The story in your head is how your brain learns what to pay attention to and what it can safely ignore.
Yeah, there's a great improv phrase, play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm going to make a connection here that's probably a leap, but we're taping this podcast at 2 in the afternoon in Chicago on the Friday, and we're at the Tribune Tower, and I just watched the Cubs parade, all right? So 5 million people are downtown right now watching the parade.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. The Cubs won the World Series. Now, I want to flash back to Game 7 because I don't know if you watched the game, but it feels to me like this is what happened with those two teams. And when you hear about when they had that rain delay and Jason Hayward from the Cubs took the team back into the weight room and basically said, you're forgetting that you're the best team. We're the best team in baseball. You're forgetting what we do and what we need to do when we go out there. And then at the rally today, David Ross, apparently one of the, I think Rizzo or one of the guys was saying he did a similar thing when they were down 3-1 and everyone was hanging their head in the locker room. He's like, don't hang your head. It's one pitch, one inning at a time, and we're the best team in baseball. And I really thought about this with regard to their manager, Joe Maddon, that while he made some pretty bad baseball decisions, what he had done prior to that, though, is build an incredible leadership culture where he allowed his people to take leadership roles, you know, inside the organization. And you can't help but think about sort of famous sports failures and successes being due to both cognitive tunneling, but also generating those kind of mental models.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the thing, is that sometimes these mental models, if they propagate without us being in charge, they can tear things completely awry, right? We've all had that moment where three things in a row go bad. Three yes. things in a row catch you off guard. And suddenly you think to yourself, God, like I can't do anything. This is right. terrible. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Literally the rest of the day is like a crap day because you have lost control of the story in your head. But someone stepping in and saying, here's what you're forgetting. We don't live in the story of us losing. We live in the story of being the best team on earth. And, mm-hmm. and I got to say, I went to college with Theo Epstein, so I have a special place in my heart for the Cubs right now.
Wow.
The thing about Theo, and I think the people he surrounds him by, and the Cubs, is they are really good at creating that story. We know that sports teams win not because they have the best players, not because they have the best strategy. They win because they have told themselves a story that beats, that allows them to persevere through adversity, because there is always going to be a moment when a team makes a mistake. There is always going to be a moment when some company has a misstep or when some member of an executive team says something stupid. There's always going to be a moment when someone on an improv stage says exactly the wrong thing and just blows up a scene.
Yep.
And if that's the story in your head, that destroys everything, there's nowhere to go. But if the story in your head is, you know what? Like, this is just an experiment. I didn't fail. I just tried an experiment and I learned that doesn't work. Then all you're doing is you're moving forward in the right direction.
Yeah, you wonder, in comedy, there's a thing called the rule of threes, that things in threes are the sort of magic recipe. And with Theo, he's got the Red Sox and the Cubs. There's no third. He jumped right to it, right? Oh, my God.
Albuquerque Astros. I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Do they need him?
He's going to go take the Astros.
That would be awesome. Oh, my God. That guy. Talk about Hall of Fame. I mean, he's got it. I'm actually curious about this. I read Adam Grant's Originals, and one of the things that I really connected to was this idea that there's power in daydreaming and procrastination that allows the sort of, you know, the mind to marinate over a difficult problem. Is that similar, do you think, to the mental modeling that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think it is. So let me sort of take another tack with this power of daydreaming and procrastination.
Please.
Here's one of the things that we know about the most productive people, and this tends to be actually the big overwhelming lesson. So in Smarter, Faster, Better, the biggest takeaway is that throughout history, people who have been most productive, it has not been because they use like a special filing system or that they, you know, are particularly good at to-do lists. The people who have been most productive is because they think a little bit more than everyone else, right? Thinking has always been the killer productivity app.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I was to say to anyone, you should think more, everyone would say, yeah, I should think more, right? Nobody's going to disagree with that. The problem is that we're all so busy all the time that when you most need to think, that's when it's easiest to forget to think.
Mm-hmm.
And so what really productive people do is they build habits into their lives that force themselves to think. Psychologists refer to these as contemplative routines, that I have a routine that forces me to think when thinking is hard. Now, for some people, those routines are things like I describe my entire day to my wife each night, and she and I have to be honest about like the mistakes I made and kind of learn from them, right? Mm-hmm. Or when I'm riding the subway on work to the morning, instead of reading my, checking my emails, I just close my eyes and I visualize my day for the next 10 minutes. Just try and figure out, what do I want to get done today? What's the most important three goals for today? For other people, those contemplative routines are things like saying, it's okay to take 10 minutes and just daydream. It's okay to procrastinate. If I don't feel like I can figure solve this problem right now, I'm going to let myself set it aside until my brain is ready. Because that's a kind of contemplative routine. It's a habit that we have learned allows us to think a little bit more deeply about the problem that's in front of us. Because the most productive people, it's not necessarily that they're working harder. It's not that they're making bigger sacrifices. It's that they are spending more time thinking about what are the most important goals? What are the insights that will get me to that goal? How do I innovate faster? How do I bring this team together? What culture should I establish so that this team becomes more productive? Thinking more deeply is the key to productivity. And finding those routines, whether they be active or whether they be something like saying, I'm going to allow myself to take a walk and daydream, finding the routines that for you allow that thought to occur, that is how you become more productive.
And that's real hard. I mean, that because you talk about this idea also for good people who are good at making decisions, that they have to develop a comfort with doubt. And there's not a lot of places to practice that. And that's the thing about improv, because that's what you're doing. You literally are doing that over and over and over again. But, you know, you get out into your workplace and there's not a lot of places that allow you to practice being comfortable with doubt.
No, not a, and in fact, there's this thing called the need for cognitive closure, that most people have this need to feel like they've made a decision and they don't have to revisit that question, or that they do the things that they're good at. And we see this in improv, right? Mm-hmm. We see that someone reaches a level in improv or in any type of activity where they have a certain degree of mastery. They have a couple of characters in their back pocket. They know they can go to them. Yep. And so they go to them again and again and again, because it kills. It's a way to end the scene. It's a way to tie things up. The reason why it becomes stale, the reason why it stops working, is because they're no longer pushing themselves to that boundary. They're no longer taking risks. Improv is all about taking risks. It's about being comfortable with taking risks. It's about being comfortable with saying, I don't know where this is going. I don't need to give in to that need for cognitive closure. And you're exactly right. It is very hard to practice that in real life, outside, off a stage. And yet what we know is that people who are comfortable with that, they are the ones who figure out how to do things faster and smarter and better. It is the key to pushing ourselves to learn faster and to be able to execute more quickly and better, is being comfortable with the fact that the path to the right answer isn't always a straight line.
Yeah, I think the business people that I've seen who are successful and creative figure out ways to build these sort of like failure labs inside their businesses. I think the improv adage, the action begins with the disruption of the normal routine. You have to, you know, and people use that term disruptive all the time now. It's sort of cliche. But the reality is nothing original comes out of comfort. It's exactly the opposite. Where all our invention comes out of is discomfort. And that is, you know, that is not unique to the arts, but it seems to be a bit to businesses, though I think they're catching on now.
I think so. And I think that these are things that probably most of the people listening sort of intuitively know are true, right? I mean, the truth of the matter is that most of us intuitively build mental models. Most of us intuitively tell ourselves stories about our days, right? We replay an important conversation in our head 10 times before we actually have it. That's because our brain craves building these mental models. We've learned that it's important for attention. The key is that these quirks, these things that allow us to think more, that our desire to procrastinate, our desire to daydream, instead of looking at that as a weakness, is to say, why do I have this instinct, this urge to do this thing? Is there something useful from it? How do I distill it down so that I squeeze all the usefulness out of it and it doesn't tip over into something that's destructive? Because you can procrastinate too much. You can daydream too much.
Yeah.
How do I get the good out of this instinct without overdosing and making it into something bad?
I do want to talk to you a bit about habits, and we don't have much time, but one of the things I love this phrase that you have when you talk about innovation, and you say creativity is actually an import-export business. And that was a really fresh insight to me. And I've been someone who's worked in a creative industry for 30 years. Can you start to talk about what is the back and forth there?
Absolutely. So there's this great strain of research that's really fascinating, where basically researchers have tried to figure out, like, why are some people more creative than others? When we say something is creative, what do we judge as creative, right? Is it just pure originality? And it turns out the answer is no. And in fact, things that are too original, things that are too creative, they tend to be seen as others as alienating instead of creative. Mm. So in fact, there's a guy named Brian Uzi, who's a researcher, and he has looked specifically at this question of how much originality should you have in something for people to see it as creative as opposed to alienating. And he figured maybe 50-50, right? Maybe 50% old ideas, 50% new ideas, that's enough that you'd see it as creative. Nope. People see it as alienating. Okay, so maybe it's 40% new stuff, 60% old stuff. Nope, still alienating. People won't even pay attention to it. Hmm. What he found for scientific papers is that the magic ratio is 95% old stuff and 5% new stuff. That's where the most creative, unquotes, papers come out of when they have that ratio. But the 5% that's new, what's really interesting about it is that it's new because it takes old ideas and it contrasts them or combines them in new ways. And to put it in the terms of entertainment, one of my favorite examples is not only West Side Story, mm-hmm. which is basically a bunch of old cliches jammed together, right? You have Romeo and Juliet set in New York City. You have a choreography that was put together by a ballet dancer and it looks a lot like Swan Lake and the Nutcracker Suite, set to kind of Latin music, a bunch of cliches jammed together that everyone says, oh, this seems so new and fresh. But think about the most popular piece of musical theater right now, Hamilton.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of cliches, right? We've been telling stories about the Founding Fathers since the Founding Fathers were born.
Right, it's 1776 with the hip-hop, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Hip-hop is 35 years old now.
Yeah.
It's basically a bunch of cliches. And yet, they take the cliches of the Founding Fathers and the cliches of hip-hop, and they jam them together, and everyone says, this seems so breathtaking and new. And that's because it's an import-export business. Mm. Lin-Manuel Miranda took a bunch of cliches and he put them together in a new way. And it seems so creative and exciting because that's what creativity is. It's taking something that we know about, something that seems familiar, and forcing us to see it in a new light by juxtaposing it with something else that we didn't see it, we've never seen it juxtaposed with before.
Sure. And you know what it makes me think of is I think the Beatles became the Beatles because of George Martin. And what George Martin brought, right? Because he brought in, it's like, no, let's bring in cellos, let's bring in strings, let's say, you know, and suddenly the sound emerges that is, again, not just new. It also tugs on something that we do know already because, you know, it's Joseph Campbell, right? We're telling the same story over and over and over again, but finding new and exciting and different ways for it to meet whatever generation we're in. I think that's a really, really powerful insight into, and would help anyone. Whether you're a marketer or whether you're trying to get a date, right? Because you really have to recognize that that's people are looking for authentic moments. So that doesn't mean that you're a total trailblazer. There are many stories for you to grasp onto.
That's exactly right. And in fact, there's a word for these folks who are able to do this. They're known within the academic literature as innovation brokers, right? And that broker is the important part, that what they do is they expose themselves to a variety of ideas, and then they broker across boundaries. They go to accounting and they learn something, and then they go to marketing and they say, you know what I just heard in accounting? Here's a kind of interesting idea. What if we try and do a marketing campaign around this? They broker between different silos of intellectual curiosity. Mm. Now, just exposing yourself to ideas, though, isn't enough. You also have to have, again, this cognitive routine, this ability to force yourself to think about what you're being exposed to. But once you put that together, that's like magic.
Wow, that's great. Okay, so we don't have much time, and I do want to touch on The Power of Habit because that was also a mind-blowing book for me. And by far, my favorite story in that is the one about Febreze. It was just amazing because Febreze was not initially successful, correct?
That's exactly right. Febreze was actually one of the biggest flops in Procter & Gamble's history. And the way that they figured out how to make it into a hit was that they had initially sold Febreze as this thing that made bad smells disappear mm-hmm. from people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you spray Febreze and you make a bad smell go away, and that's the reward that's supposed to make you crave Febreze. And they figured out why this wasn't working when they talked to this woman who lived out right outside of Arizona and who owned about 27 cats. And they walked into this woman's house, and the smell of cats is overwhelming, right?
Right.
It's so much so that this guy had started, one of the researchers had started gagging when they walked into mm-hmm. her living room. And they had sent this woman a couple bottles of Febreze for free to sort of see if she would like it. And they're talking to the woman, and they say, you know, do you use the Febreze that we sent you? And she says, yeah, you know, once or twice I've used it. And the guy, one of them says, you know, do you ever use it for the cat scent? And the woman says, yeah, you know, once or twice for like, you know, I have a lot of cats. Sometimes they smell like cats. And the guy who literally had just been gagging, he says, well, what about right now? Would you consider using the Febreze right now? And the woman says, you know, I don't mean to be like a prideful person, but I have the best cats. They hardly ever smell. Mm-hmm. At which point the team realized why Febreze wasn't selling is because if people have bad smells in their life, they have no idea that they have bad smells in their life,
mm-hmm.
right? This is if you're trying to create some type of craving for a product and the reward that you deliver is a reward that people don't even realize is rewarding, then they're never going to start using it. So the team from Procter & Gamble, they go back to their laboratory. What they realize is that they need to make Febreze smell like something. Up till then, Febreze just made bad smells disappear. So they invent a perfume that is strong enough that they can pour it into bottles of Febreze and give Febreze a scent. And then that way people will start spraying it. Because that way, after you've cleaned something in your house, you spray Febreze to make things smell as good as they look. It has to have its own scent. And that's when Febreze sales take off.
Hmm.
But the lesson there is that we can all come up with things that should be rewarding for other people, right? I can come up with things that my kids should love. I can tell myself that when I go for a run in the morning, I'm going to drink a kale smoothie afterwards as a reward because I should love kale smoothies. But the truth of the matter is that that's not going to get me to exercise. It's not going to create an exercise habit because nobody likes kale smoothies. What I need to do is I need to give myself a piece of chocolate after I go exercising. I need to give myself a reward that's genuinely rewarding, and that's how a habit will take root. Otherwise, it's just kind of a fool's errand.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, I don't know if it's funny, when you read about the power of habit and you realize it comes to you rather quickly, it's sort of like, oh my God, I fall into this trap all the time, right? And you know, I think you want it to be simple. And I'm curious for you, because I know you talk about the origin of working on the book, but do you find, I know Kurt Vonnegut said the act of writing is all discovery. Do you go in thinking you're going to write about one thing and then all these other things pop up and then you're in a rabbit hole yourself?
Not so much. And I apologize. I have to Skype with some class.
Yeah, you got it.
College class.
This will be our last question.
No, you know what I would say actually happens to me? It is. So I think Kurt Vonnegut is right that I feel like it is the act of discovery. It's not so much that I think that it's going to go one direction and it ends up going a different direction. It's that when I start writing a book, for instance, I have no idea what direction it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And part of writing a book or part of writing anything is just trusting the process, right? Trusting that I have no idea how I'm going to finish this story. I have no idea how I'm going to finish this chapter. I have no idea how I'm going to say something important. But that if I commit to the process, that halfway through writing this chapter, it's going to tell me where it's supposed to go. That I can give in to the process, because the process, as long as I commit to it, the process is going to show me the right way forward.
That's great. Charles Duhigg, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
This is Second City Works, getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.